Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin leads the nation in the production of specialty cheeses, accounting for 47% of the total? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Hey, thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is Katie, HRN Executive Director, and I'm so excited to share with you our coverage from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival.
We are here live today at Charleston Wine and Food.
Join us as we talk all things food.
Come to Charleston, eat some seafood. Eat all of the seafood.
Chicken fried chicken with chorizo steak and salsa verde mashed potatoes.
So quintessentially like Southern fare at its finest.
And have important conversations.
We're also talking about professional women in restaurants and how underrepresented they are, people of color in restaurants, and how they're not talked about.
We get real with Food Network's Manit Chauhan.
Balance is BS. I was told that I wasn't going to be bleeped out.
And find out about raising sugarcane with Chef Sean Brock.
It's like being Indiana Jones or something. You never know what you're going to find.
You'll come away inspired by the power of food and the food scene in Charleston. Here's Dr. Jessica B. Harris.
Food is constantly in flux. Food is always moving. Food is the only real lingua franca that we have that allows us to connect with other folks.
So tune in to Heritage Radio Network on tour at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't go wrong.
Yes, that's right. It's Monday. It's time for another episode of What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and this is the Heritage Radio Network. We are broadcasting from Bushwick, Brooklyn, in the back of Roberta's Restaurant. And today we're going to be talking antitrust. And you know, people who have listened to me for a while know that this has been a hobby horse for about 2 years, probably. And so it is my very great pleasure to introduce my guest today, Diana Moss, who is the president of the American Antitrust Institute, which she ascended to the mantle of greatness in January of 2015. She is an economist, and Dr. Moss has developed and expanded American Antitrust Institute's advocacy channels and strategies, as well as strengthened their communications with enforcers, Congress, other advocacy groups, and the media. Her work spans both antitrust and regulation, with industry expertise in electricity, petroleum, agriculture, airlines, telecommunications, and healthcare. Now, this is the kind of CV that really makes me feel insecure. I just want to remind you, like, I don't have any of those accomplishments. It just kills me when I read this stuff. I hardly dare go on, but I'm going to, just because you were at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, where you coordinated the agency's competition analysis for electricity mergers. Boy, you have an incredible career. I'm not going to go on just because we have so much to talk about. But if people want to learn more about Dr. Moss, you can go to the AmericanAntitrustInstitute.org website and learn more about her extraordinary work in the field of antitrust and regulatory practices. So welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me today, Diane. I really appreciate your time. And so I wondered if you would just start by telling people a little bit about the American Antitrust Institute and what you guys are doing there.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure and an honor and always a much looked forward to opportunity to connect with the public on antitrust issues. So AAI is the leading progressive voice in antitrust advocacy. We are a nonprofit based in D.C. We're 20 years old this year. We're very excited about that milestone. And we do three things. We do research, we educate, and we advocate on issues relating to fair competition and promoting consumer welfare. We do that through a variety of channels. We put on conferences. We work with the Hill, the enforcement agencies, both state and federal regulators. We communicate a lot with the media because it's a very important channel to consumers to understand sometimes complex issues around competition. And so we have a big network. We work a lot with other advocacy organizations in food and airlines and healthcare. So it's a very effective way to communicate and unpack these competition issues, issues that all Americans should be very concerned about and interested in.
I couldn't agree with you more. I find the consolidation across the board of industry really terrifying. And it's not even just in our country. It's like they're now sort of all these huge multinationals. It's what I had this horrible boyfriend when I was a teenager, but I remember him constantly railing about multinationals. And I always thought, what is he talking about? I don't know what he's talking about. Well, that was back in the 70s. And by golly, he was right. I mean, it's these global oligarchy kind of, I'm not even using the right words, but it's a very frightening prospect to think that at this point, say, for example, we only have, four big agrochemical companies? We're going to talk about those in a second. But you had a background in energy, but you're most involved in agricultural cases. So tell us what you're working on right now with in terms of agriculture, because that's what most of my listeners are interested in.
Absolutely, absolutely. So NAI has a big program in food and agriculture, and that spans, the policy issues, the legal issues, the economic issues around consolidation, and various forms of what we call restrictive or anti-competitive conduct that's designed to exclude rivals from the market, mm-hmm. usually smaller, more innovative rivals. But also agreements that are anti-competitive, that restrain competition. So we have a long line of advocacy in agricultural biotech. We've been riding on Monsanto and, that string of mergers over mm-hmm. time. The use of intellectual property, for example, for transgenic seed. These seeds are patented. The traits are patented as a way to sort of control competition in the space. We just advocated really strongly on the merger of Monsanto and Bayer. We wrote two pieces on that, explaining why we think the merger would be really incredibly anti-competitive and anti-consumer, but also focused on important emerging issues around agricultural data or agridata, which is a big motivator for consolidation in the industry now. So, we have really pointed out that the level of consolidation, not only in ag biotech, but in processing, in manufacturing of foods, in mm-hmm. the distribution of foods, and in the retailing of foods through grocery, has really created what we think is a supply chain that looks like an hourglass, mm-hmm. meaning we have just very few large companies in the sort of in the middle of the hourglass in the processing, manufacturing, and even retail grocery segments. But we have lots of farmers, lots of growers, lots of producers of agricultural products, and we have lots of eaters, lots of consumers at the bottom.
Yeah,
and
that's
so,
right.
What happens in a situation like that is, farmers and growers are selling into markets with significant market power. They're getting squeezed at every step of the way, and consumers at the other end of the hourglass are also getting squeezed because they're paying higher prices for essential commodities like food.
So even though the companies point to their streamlined practices and these mergers and acquisitions allow them to significantly streamline their bottom line, as it were, I mean, isn't that the excuse for all of these mergers and acquisitions, that is, it will ultimately benefit the consumer because of the sort of more slick and slimmed down corporate structure will then allow prices to go down? But you don't see that as something that really happens?
We don't. We're very skeptical of that, and we've, in our advocacy, have really highlighted the fallacy of those arguments. Arguably, for the last 30 years, antitrust enforcement in the U.S. has been lax.
Yeah.
enforcers have given great deference to these claims of cost savings and consumer benefits and other efficiencies that you were just speaking to. The scary part of that story is, when companies come in and make their claims as to why a merger is pro-competitive, the agencies, meaning the U.S. Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission and state enforcers, do a fairly rigorous analysis to prove that those efficiencies are actually related to the merger and that they are going to actually going to materialize. But here's the problem. The hitch is that once the merger is approved, the companies don't have to come back and show that they actually realize those cost savings and benefits. So, you know, once they get their the green light and the merger is a go, they're on their way. They don't have to come back and show that they actually realize those benefits. Mm-hmm. And many of those benefits in our view and in our writings and our analysis have not been proven up. Mm-hmm. And so consumers are not benefiting through more efficient operations and having cost savings passed through to them, or having newer, better products, you know, faster to market and that sort of thing. It's a real problem in our enforcement regime right now.
Would you? I agree. I totally agree. I mean, I've been following the class action suits that have been brought against some of the big poultry producers, for example, who are actually being attacked both by grocery stores and by farmers who are, you know, who got their first pay raise in, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, just this past winter. So, mm-hmm. you know, nobody but the companies seem to be benefiting from these extraordinary consolidations. But as far as that goes in the agricultural sector, do you see agrochemicals and seeds as kind of the most sort of scary? You know, because when you obviously you guys have written a lot about the proposed Monsanto Bayer merger, and as well as the Dow DuPont and the Syngenta ChemChina, you know, do those pose sort of more of a threat, would you say, overall to sort of national food security, if you will, and to farmers? Or is it more like the sort of the companies that are processing and manufacturing, like in dairy and meat? You know, which yeah, where is it worse?
right. Really, really good question. I don't know. You know, I think it's all pretty bad. And one reason, well, there's a few reasons, but one major reason is because farmers are getting squeezed. They get squeezed on both ends. So
yeah.
For example, with mergers of agricultural biotechs like Monsanto and Bayer and Dow and DuPont, which went through a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. you know, those mergers create market power, significant market power in genetic traits for crop seed and seeds and chemicals. So farmers pay higher input prices. They're also paying high input prices for fertilizer because we essentially have a fertilizer cartel out there.
Right.
So they pay higher prices, but then they sell their commodities into markets where there's market power. So take flour milling, for example, the Ardent Mills Horizon combination. You know, there are current deals on deck to further consolidate grain processing. Mm-hmm. So then they're selling into markets where there's also market power, but on the buyer side. And so they are mm-hmm. Getting squeezed on that end as well. So all through the supply chain, you know, you find different segments, the processors, manufacturers, the retail grocers, kind of bulking up sumo wrestler style to be bigger mm-hmm. so they can bargain more effectively with their customers or their distributors. So that's what's led to this sort of, you know, this bottleneck supply chain that we're dealing with. Bottom line is the essential farming community and growing community and producing community, which is critical to the national health and the national security, is getting squeezed. And consumers are having to make really, really difficult choices about whether to buy food, to buy high-quality food, or to pay their energy bills. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it all combines, because it is such an integrated supply chain, it all combines to be, you know, to all be concerning.
Mm. You're painting a very dark picture there, Diana. Yeah. I'm trembling right now. So let's talk for a second about the legislation that was imposed in the earlier part of the 20th century, the Clayton Act and the Sherman Act, which, and you know, other legislative remedies that I undoubtedly do not know about, that were meant to prevent these consolidations to a certain extent. Why haven't those laws been invoked to slow down the pace of these mergers? And when do you think when did this merger and acquisition frenzy begin? Was this like back in the 70s and 80s? Let me ask this. Can we dump this on Reagan and Thatcher too? Is this is this part of their nefarious plan?
Well, you know, it's the result of a lot of converging forces. So you know, the laws are over 100 years old. They were absolutely designed to restrain the growth of dominant firms and trusts mm-hmm. and the exercise of market power. And in antitrust, we talk about three different, you know, sort of problems. One is merger control. combining firms either in horizontal or vertical combinations.
Right.
Another is monopolization, preventing large dominant firms from excluding their rivals. And another is agreements, or what are often known as cartel types of agreements. So those laws were badly needed in the late 1800s and early 1900s. We went through a period up through the 50s where there was pretty vigorous enforcement. Then in the 70s, there was sort of a new ideology took hold, and that was really driven by a school of thought, if you will, that we should be giving great deference to the efficiencies that are generated by some mergers and certain forms of conduct. And that really sort of galloped out of control for some time. Economists then were wrapped into the whole antitrust process. Economists, as you might expect, are fond of models and numbers and quantitative types of analyses. And so we ended up with a system that really just focused on giving lots of wide berth to these efficiency claims, but also just, you know, focusing a lot on just prices. Well, we all know that competition is more about price, right? It's about quality, about innovation, it's about service and variety. And so we had a whole swath of consolidation, which is now, you know, to pun badly, the chickens are coming home to roost, because now we're dealing with industries with just a few large firms, high levels of concentration, and now for enforcement, it's a question of how do we deal with this? You know, how do we unwind some of these big mergers? Well, that's going to be tough. We've got to really be vigilant about merger control. We've got to be vigilant about forcing companies to prove up their efficiencies claims. And there is legislation in Congress right now. Senator Klobuchar from Minnesota has proposed some really constructive reforms that would really update the laws and hold feet to the fire on these types of claims.
Interesting. I'm sure that's not a popular. I'm tipping my hand as like a total card carrying liberal here, but I can't imagine that it's all that popular to think of unwinding or otherwise curtailing what is clearly very lucrative for many members of Congress to support giant mergers and acquisitions. I mean, they just don't have any reason not to, because then they don't get the big bucks for their campaigns, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, that's a really good point. But here, I'm going to make a kind of a counterpoint to that.
Okay, please
do. That's been sort of the thinking thus far. And antitrust does have a history of sort of political orientation, meaning, you know, Democrats have typically favored strong enforcement. They recognize the importance of markets. As sort of a central focus of our democratic society and entrepreneurial freedom and consumer freedom. Republicans, not all, have been more on the pro-business side of things. You know, that's changing. Why is it changing? Because we're now suffering the ill effects of declining competition, right? We've got just a few firms in all of our major industries. We've got big inequality gaps now. We've got slowing rates of startups, especially in food and ag, by the way. Mm-hmm. And so everybody, regardless of political leaning, should be concerned about that. We should all be concerned about protecting our markets, protecting, the democratic values that sort of underpin them. Mm-hmm. And so I think we are seeing in Washington more of a, of an awareness of the importance of antitrust enforcement for those reasons.
And just to be clear, what does the USDA or the FDA, play any role in fostering competition, or do they just go along and do what they're told by the Justice Department?
Yeah, so they are, those are sort of sector regulators. They're administrative agencies, and they sort of promulgate rules and standards which govern how their underlying laws and statutes are enforced. Antitrust is really different. Antitrust is law enforcement, right?
Right.
I mean, the goal of antitrust is essentially to deter illegal behavior. And I know it sounds weird to talk like this in terms of antitrust, but it's absolutely true. We should remind ourselves, antitrust is law enforcement.
Yeah.
It is designed to apply the laws and to make findings of fact, subject to judicial review, about whether a merger is illegal, whether a form of you know, monopolistic conduct is illegal, whether agreements are illegal. So law enforcers operate very differently than the sector regulators. But importantly, they do collaborate. They coordinate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, USDA, for example, was just given a seat on on the CFIUS board, which, you know, reviews mergers for the purpose of whether they pose national security concerns.
Oh, right. A CFI. I want
to agencies take comments from USDA and from the FERC and from the mm-hmm. Federal Communications Commission. So they do coordinate in an important partnership.
Right. Yeah. That's such an interesting agency, the CFI USA. I actually wrote an article about foreign acquisition of American agricultural land, and I learned a lot about that agency. It's completely shadowed. It's a very opaque committee, and they don't have to give. As I understood it, they don't have to give any reasons for why they decide one way or the other about issues. Isn't that true? There's no sort of transparency. Public transparency.
It absolutely is opaque. Yeah, and really the focus for CFIUS is to evaluate whether a merger by an acquisition by a foreign company would pose national security concerns.
Right.
We are of the view as competition advocates that absolutely the food supply chain is a national security concern.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So in the merger of Syngenta, which is one of the big ag biotechs, and ChemChina, which is the state-owned agriculture state-owned company in China,
right.
We were very concerned about the ability of a Chinese company to procure and control intellectual property, which is used by Syngenta to produce new products and crops, traits. We were very concerned about that, absolutely.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean that a CFIUS review or decision should trump that's another bad pun. I apologize. Should trump antitrust. Those should be very parallel processes. So the antitrust agencies should do their thing looking at these deals. CFIUS should do its thing and looking at these deals.
Yeah.
And the two should sort of inform each other.
Right. And yet they're a very powerful, I mean, obviously those are very powerful companies, and they will... they will exert as much pressure on legislators to allow, and the Department of Justice to allow those types of acquisitions to go through. I mean, I do want to talk about all three of those all three of those mergers. So Dow and DuPont have merged. That is a done deal, right?
Correct.
But those are both American companies, if I'm not mistaken. Monsanto and Bayer is a Swiss company or a German company?
German.
And I think Syngenta is Swiss, isn't it?
That is correct.
Okay, so, and ChemChina. So, the latter two are disturbing for the very reasons that you've just explained, which essentially has to do with intellectual property and ultimately food security for Americans going forward. So let's talk a little bit about why these mergers really do matter to consumers. Like when we talk about food security in the future, why is that something that American consumers should be concerned about when there are two foreign companies like ChemChina and Syngenta, for example, that are coming together potentially and will control a large sector of the agrochemical and seed sector of this country. Why does that matter to American consumers?
Yeah, so a couple of reasons. So the international spin on this is a really important one. So if we have a foreign state-owned entity or state-controlled entity like ChemChina controlling a company that does business in the United States, there may be a misalignment of incentives. So in other words, what's good for the Chinese, what the Chinese want to promote and to push to see Chinese consumers, it may not align with what we want to promote here in the United States to benefit U.S. consumers in terms of high-quality foods, safe foods, diversity of foods, and that includes a combination of both GMO and conventionally bred crops.
Right.
So having foreign influence with their own agenda, very potentially very different looking agenda, could spell trouble for U.S. consumers, and that very much is a national security concern. The other thing is when you have these big global footprint companies, you know, with different incentives and different constituencies and consumer bases to address, you know, removing a competition from the supply chain is really potentially deadly because it's food. So one concern is that if you only have a couple of suppliers in a supply chain because of consolidation, you're really creating a lot of fragility and instability in that supply chain.
Yeah.
So what if there was a weather event, right, or an incidence of crop-borne disease or food contamination?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having, you know, five companies that, you know, could step in a crisis like that, that weren't exposed to the shock, the disease, or the contamination.
Yeah.
You only have two.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have two companies, you know, the chances of the whole supply chain going down are much higher than when you have a lot of competition, a lot of diversity, where other companies might not be exposed to those types of shocks. Same thing goes for incidents of potential bioterrorism.
Yeah.
If you have two companies controlling a supply chain, the risk that a bioterrorist kind of attack, you know, taking down the whole supply chain is much higher than if you have a lot of competition and diversity.
Absolutely.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh, and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious, stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Sutari's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm on the line with Diana Moss, who is the president of the American Antitrust Institute. And we were just talking about the impact on farmers of this wave of agrochemical companies coming together in mergers, some which have gone through, like the Dow DuPont, and others which are pending, such as the Monsanto Bayer and the ChemChina Syngenta mergers. And so we were just talking about how that squeezes farmers, because then they don't have as much, you know, as many different possibilities for where they buy their seeds. I mean, what is the end game on this, Diana? What do you think will happen in the end? Like, if there's only four companies and then there's two, how do they maintain, you know, their economic viability when the supply chain is so consolidated?
Well, I think the answer is they don't necessarily, you know, maintain their viability. If they're getting squeezed by paying higher prices for seeds and chemicals and fertilizer, because those industries have consolidated through merger, but then they are squeezed when they sell their products into to processors and to manufacturers because those industries have consolidated significantly.
Yeah.
We call it the farm margin. It goes down, paying higher input prices, receiving lower prices for their commodities. So, you know, we're losing family farms, by the hundreds and thousands every year. And those farms some of these farms are 100, 200-year-old farms.
Oh, yeah.
Are leaving the market. They're being bought out or consolidated with other larger organizations.
Yeah.
And so we're losing a really critical element in our farming community, which is the small farm, which is farmers who are much more attuned to providing high-quality products and selling those products to consumers who value quality and diversity and sustainable farming. So it's a big problem. You know, the industrial food system is a force to contend with in the United States. But we also need alternative food systems as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, that's pretty much what this program is about. That's kind of my hobby horse. I wanted to just get a second to talk with you about the tariffs that are being proposed, the possibility of a trade war with China, which is our third largest trading partner in the world, and also the renegotiations of NAFTA. Like, how do those play into the antitrust picture? Do they overlap in some way? I'm just curious, like how those political machinations affect the big agribusinesses that you and I have just been talking about.
Right. So there are a couple of angles to consider on that question. You know, any sort of tariff policy, as we're seeing with aluminum and solar cells and soybeans, that doesn't, as an economist, I can say this, that doesn't really pass the vomit test on trade 101. We know that import tariffs will raise prices in the United States and will absolutely harm producers in the United States. And that, unfortunately, with this latest round of tariff proposals, will include American farmers who are already being squeezed and struggling. So it affects antitrust to the extent that it affects prices in the United States. And whenever you do an antitrust analysis, you know, the first thing you go to is to look at what, you know, prices have done for the products and services in question. Another thing about trade policy is, and it looks like with this president, you know, we're seeing trade policy used as a protectionist kind of device. And but trade policy shouldn't trump, you know, competition policy. It's really important to enforce the competition laws, you know, both domestically and to work with other countries in a cooperative way to promote open trade and competition enforcement. But the trade law shouldn't be used as a cudgel, and they certainly shouldn't supplant good competition enforcement and cooperation across jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I think that's where this is heading. And I'm sure enforcers are very concerned about this.
Yeah, and yet there is a sector in the farming population. I'm sure you know this guy. I'm interviewing someone named Michael Stumo next week, who is the CEO of the Coalition for a Prosperous America. And I learned about Michael through Mike Calicrate. And, you know, all of these guys are involved in the Organization for Competitive Markets and so on. And so I find it fascinating that many of them are very much in favor of these tariffs and very much in favor of renegotiating NAFTA. Because I'm liberal and a globalist in general, I don't see that even if you weren't, the cow's out of the barn. You can't really change what's happening around the world. Mm-hmm. If you want to play the game, you got to be in it with all of the players. And right. And the idea that these guys are kind of, you know, cleaving to this idea of, as you described it, protectionist policies, particularly towards agriculture, but obviously with other industries in mind as well. I mean, it just doesn't make economic sense to me. And I'm by no means an economist. I can barely do math. So if it seems incomprehensible to me, I mean, I'm not alone in those deficits. I mean, can you explain why this would be appealing to some sectors of the agricultural community?
Well, you know, I think the messaging, the public messaging on tariffs is, you know, oh great, this is we need to protect American producers. Tariffs will protect American producers. That may be sort of an immediate response or reaction to that, but in the long run, once the trade system has done its work and prices sort of reflect the effect of those tariff policies, prices in the U.S. are going to go up. They're absolutely going to go up, and that's going to harm U.S. consumers, and it's going to potentially affect the production of any good that uses soybeans or other commodities in as an input into some final food product.
Right.
So, you know, it's sort of a staged kind of thing. Immediately, it may sound attractive, but in the long run, when it all comes through in the wash, we're absolutely going to see higher prices, and we're going to see it instances where it's harder for smaller rivals in the United States to compete. I think what you might be hearing from these guys, and they are terrific, terrific people. They're smart and they're engaged and they're, they're advocates to the farming community. You know, NAFTA, the trade agreements are another story. So, for example, you know, country of origin labeling has been a very big issue.
Yes.
And it should be a big issue.
I agree.
Why? Because if American producers are going to produce higher quality products, beef and other meats, then consumers should absolutely be able to know that.
Yeah.
And be able to make choices about what they consume. Like I would pay a bit more to know that my meat was sustainably raised or humanely raised or safer and more secure.
Yeah.
But the country of origin labeling has resisted those labeling efforts. And so, you know, but that's sort of a trade agreement kind of issue, which is a bit separate from the trade tariffs.
Well, my understanding of why country of origin labeling failed was essentially that aside from the WTO levying the big fines, it was really because the very large packers, you know, the Cargills, the Smithfields, the Tysons, et cetera, they're bringing in, beef primarily from, you know, maybe 103 other nations, and they don't want to have to label that separately. And they call it a marketing issue. I call it a way of duping the public, but that's my opinion.
Right. I agree with you. Absolutely. But remember, the consumer should be king. And unfortunately, with all this consolidation, the consumer is no longer king. The consumer has less choice, less variety, less quality. We see less innovation. But, labeling gives American producers a legitimate way to distinguish their products as being higher quality from other rivals. Why shouldn't they be able to do that?
I couldn't agree more. I absolutely am. Not only that, I even said that on the Dr. Oz show when I was a guest. Okay, we just have a couple minutes left, so I'm going to ask you the final question here, and then you should promote the American Antitrust Institute shamelessly for the remainder of the program. But one more question, which is, aside from the work that you do or guys like the, you know, Organization for Competitive Markets, what are the remedies to fight back against these giant companies? Because, I mean, as we said before, you can't really, there's really no mechanism to kind of unwind them or force them to break into smaller pieces again, is there? I mean, there's no way we can, like, put the cow back in the barn, can we?
We can. I mean, you can, to some extent, put, it's hard, I mean, but the genie can be put back in the bottle or the toothpaste back into the tube. And the way we do that is through Section 2 of the Sherman Act. Section 2 prohibits monopolies that restrain trade. And so, unfortunately, Section 2, we call them Section 2 cases or monopolization cases, are a really heavy lift for enforcers. I can count the number of monopolization cases brought by the U.S. agencies in the last 20 years on two hands. The standards of proof are really high. There's a lot of analysis that goes into them. But absolutely, Section 2 can be used to unwind or to break up companies that have engaged in harmful exclusionary conduct that restrains competition and harms consumers. We saw that with the AT&T case, right?
Right.
Back in
we sure
the
did.
Day.
Yep,
we
back in the day.
We almost saw it with Microsoft, but then there was a hard swerve to a remedy that, wasn't very effective in that case. But Section 2 is a big political lift. You need a lot of support for that type of and that vigor of enforcement. So people shouldn't forget about that.
Yeah.
Cartel enforcement is really active. So DOJ in particular is busting cartels, you know, pretty aggressively. Merger control is ticking up. You know, we've seen a lot of mergers challenged and successfully blocked. AT&T Time Warner is right now in trial.
Uh-huh.
I think the government has a very good chance of winning that case. So we need to see more aggressive, more vigorous enforcement across the board.
Mm-hmm. And do you see this particular administration or our current Congress as being more interested in doing that or less interested in doing it as compared with, say, the Obama or even the Bush administrations?
I think there's more interest. There's certainly in the House Judiciary Committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee and the, you know, the economics committees and transportation and industry related committees, there is interest. And we are seeing interest of a more bipartisan nature. Why? Mm-hmm. Because everyone sees the concerns with declining competition, big and, you know, growing inequality gaps, and the importance of protecting and nurturing our markets. And yeah. Antitrust enforcers are the referees. They're like the referees in the markets, and we need them there. You can't play a game on a level playing field without a referee. So I think we have, there's more appeal for vigorous enforcement. With that said, we've seen some really good legislative proposals come out, and there will be more.
Uh-huh.
With that said, I think you have to carve off what you're hearing from the White House. Because what we heard from the White House is not part of a coherent antitrust enforcement policy or strategy.
Right.
It is really just targeted attacks on particular companies for political reasons. So I don't think there's any rhyme or reason to that rhetoric. But I do think in Congress and at the agencies, we are seeing a growing recognition for the need for cohesion and a coherent policy.
Right. Well, on that note, I'll let you go. But gosh, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. What an interesting discussion. Thank you so very much. Now you can tell people a little bit more about American Antitrust Institute, how they can support your organization and learn more about your work.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. And, you know, we absolutely spend a lot of our time talking to consumers, to small businesses, to large businesses that are often on the receiving end of mm-hmm. anti-competitive, you know, conduct or strategies. So we spend a lot of time talking to folks, hearing stories, putting our stories together, doing our analysis. I would encourage everyone to reach out to us. To look at our website and see what we write and how we write it at antitrustinstitute.org. And we certainly encourage contributions to the organization. We are a nonprofit on a shoestring budget,
right.
And every little bit helps.
Yeah.
So we're very happy to engage with the public as much as we can on these issues.
That's great. Well, thank you again, Diana, for joining me today. This has been really terrific and very, very informative and interesting for me, and I hope for everybody else. But really, it's all about me, just so you know.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Okay. Until next week, folks, thanks to my sponsor, Wisconsin Cheese. Love you guys. And thanks, as always, to my listeners for listening. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.